He was staring me down in just an intense hatred. I actually thought, you know, I am within a minute of dying based on the look in his eye.
The murder trial of a Tanana man who killed two state troopers gets underway in Fairbanks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers work on an oil tax overhaul.
It's just hard to say, okay, Alaskans, it's time for you to cut your permanent fund dividend in half so the oil industry can benefit from that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
A Fairbanks jury has begun hearing the case of a Tanana man charged with killing two Alaska State Troopers in the Interior Village. 22-year-old Nathaniel Kangas shot Trooper Gabe Rich and Sergeant Scott Johnson while they were trying to arrest his father at the Kangas home on May 1, 2014. During his opening statement on Monday, District Attorney Greg Olson began making the case for first-degree murder convictions.
The evidence is going to show you that that tragedy was perpetrated by Nathaniel Kangas, who ambushed and slaughtered those two state troopers as they were trying to do their job.
Olson recalled how the troopers came to the village after Nathaniel Kangas' father, Arvin Kangas, threatened the local village public safety officer. Johnson and Rich were shot while trying to take the uncooperative elder Kangas into custody. Nathaniel Kangas' attorney, Greg Parvin, did not dispute what happened, but asserted Kangas' actions were not premeditated.
He reacted. He reacted impulsively, and he reacted illegally. And with that, he will be found guilty, but not of the crimes the state has charged.
Parvin said the state cannot meet the burden of proof for first-degree murder. Opening day witnesses called by the state included Nathaniel Kangas' mother, Judy Kangas, who recounted finding her son in his bedroom with an automatic rifle while troopers were trying to arrest his father on the front porch.
I don't remember if I grabbed the gun or if he put it down. And I told him no.
Kangas took up the rifle again after his mother left the room, shooting the troopers at close range as they wrestled with his father. Kangas then aimed the gun at longtime Tanana VPSO Mark Haglin.
He was staring me down in just an intense hatred. I actually thought, you know, I am within a minute of dying based on the look in his eye.
Haglin, who said he's known the Kangases for years, was able to talk Nathaniel down. Haglin escaped the scene, and while he ran for help, Nathaniel and Arvin Kangas went to the tribal office, where employee Judy Ellen Gao testified she witnessed a distraught Nathaniel Kangas.
He sat down and he was crying, saying, "Oh my God, I shot him. And then he said, "I can't see what the white man made me do."
Gao said her impression was that Nathaniel Kangas was brainwashed by his father and other local members of an extremist sovereignty group known as the Athabascan Nation. Both Kangases were taken into custody without incident. Arvin Kangas was convicted of evidence tampering for moving the fallen troopers' bodies and removing their guns from their holsters. Nathaniel Kangas' murder trial continued today in Fairbanks Superior Court. After weeks of delays, a bill to overhaul the state's oil and gas taxes could advance quickly. The House Rules Committee held the first public hearing in more than 3 weeks on the legislation today. The committee's version of the bill would phase out refundable tax credits over the next 3 years. Chairman, Anchorage Republican Craig Johnson says the bill draws on input from industry as well as lawmakers from both parties.
We'd like to continue incentivizing companies. The question is, what can we afford? And I don't know that we can afford to continue writing checks to oil companies in this environment.
The bill initially doesn't go as far as Governor Bill Walker's proposal to reduce subsidies, but once the reductions are fully phased in, they would be similar to Walker's. Anchorage Democratic Representative Chris Tuck says the new version doesn't cut subsidies quickly enough.
It's just hard to say, okay, Alaskans, it's time for you to cut your permanent fund dividend in half so the oil industry can benefit from that, because basically that's what we're doing, is we're asking Alaskans to pull out of their pocket and subsidize the largest industry in the world.
Tuck says reducing the tax subsidies more quickly is important to closing the state's budget deficit. But Johnson says the new version of the bill is fair to companies that have made their plans around the current tax system.
We still give everyone an opportunity to proceed. We give them time to get partners. We give them time to readjust their business plans. But I think mainly we generate revenue for the state, and we basically, once again, stop the hemorrhaging.
The Rules Committee will take public testimony on the bill tomorrow. Johnson says he wants to finish work on the bill, including amendments, tomorrow as well. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Shell gives up all but one Chukchi Sea lease.
The companies have decided that low oil prices combined with having no idea what the federal government will require in the future are just too expensive.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, working with more than 100 Alaska communities and thousands of Alaskans. Today, ExxonMobil is producing natural gas condensate from the Point Thompson facilities.
Shell is giving up all but one of its leases in the Chukchi Sea. The announcement comes 7 months after Shell announced it was halting exploration in Alaska's offshore Arctic for the foreseeable future. Governor Bill Walker calls the news disappointing. Michael Levine of the conservation group Oceana says the lease surrenders underscore Shell's exit.
They're significant because they really call to an end this era of exploration, at least in the Chukchi Sea.
To Oceana and other anti-drilling groups, Shell's decision shows industry can't make offshore drilling work in the Alaskan Arctic when companies are held to high safety standards. They say it's a sign the federal government should not include the Arctic in its next offshore leasing plan. Sarah Erkman of the trade group Alaska Oil and Gas Association sees other contributing factors.
Uncertainty comes at a cost, and frankly, the companies have decided that low oil prices combined with having no idea what the rules will, the federal government will require in the future are just too expensive and are unsustainable in this low price environment.
Shell spokesman Curtis Smith cited high costs and an unpredictable regulatory environment, but also the poor results from Berger J, the sole test well Shell completed in its $7 billion Arctic program. Shell paid more than $2 billion for its Chukchi leases. To keep them, the company would have to pay about $40 million in rent over the next 4 years, by Oceana's calculations. Shell will retain its lease to the Berger J site, which Smith says will allow it to keep proprietary data. Shell says it's still evaluating whether to retain its leases in the Beaufort Sea, but the company will literally pull up stakes this summer. The spokesman says Shell will return to the Arctic to retrieve 55 anchors it left on the floor of the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. A worker with a hand wrench sparked the fire that last month that shut down the Trans-Alaska pipeline for 9 hours. The fire forced the evacuation of more than 50 people working at a remote pump station near Coldfoot at the edge of the Brooks Range. The Alaska Pipeline Service Company, which operates the pipeline, is investigating the cause of the fire. Spokeswoman Michelle Egan says a technician was working at the top of an oil storage tank with an adjustable wrench.
And he was using a hand tool, and that hand tool slipped and struck a hard object, and that likely caused a spark. Then he saw flames, about 3 inches of flames, around the outside of this panel that he was working on.
The storage tank has vents that allow crude oil vapors to escape, and the spark likely ignited those. The company has strict regulations for most work around tanks, especially with power tools, but it wasn't clear that work with a hand tool could cause a fire.
Clearly, we did not anticipate that with this kind of work that he was doing, that vapors would be present and that this could occur.
The company is re-examining its regulations. By the time the technician had climbed down from the tank to retrieve a fire extinguisher, the fire was too large for him to control by himself. The full pipeline was shut down within minutes. An on-site fire crew initially held off to see if the fire would go out by itself. When the crew finally did go in just after midnight, the fire was extinguished within minutes. The pipeline itself was restarted before the fire was put out. Egan says by that point, operators were confident the pump station was isolated from the full pipeline. Alyeska is continuing its investigation. The full results are expected within the next few weeks, but will not be released publicly. Icicle Seafoods has a new owner. Canadian-based Cook Seafood announced it had signed a definitive agreement to buy Icicle's whole operation. Cook is a 30-year-old farmed salmon company from Canada's East Coast and knows there will be much to learn about the wild Alaska fisheries it just bought into. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Icicle Seafood started small in Petersburg and grew into one of the largest seafood companies in North America. In 2007, private equity firm Payne & Partners acquired Icicle and began looking to sell it whole or in pieces a little over a year ago. Outlets like Undercurrent News and IntraFish aggressively covered the pending sale, tracking as other U.S. companies like Trident, Copper River, and Silver Bay, several foreign seafood giants, and even some of Alaska's CDQs expressed interest. Last June, Icicle inked a deal with wealthy Indonesian investors, but that fell through by September. Enter Cook Aquaculture, which hails from the small coastal town of Black's Harbor in New Brunswick on Canada's east coast. Nell Halse is a spokesperson for the company.
Cook is owned by Glenn Cook. He's the CEO, and his father and his brother started the company 30 years ago, primarily farming salmon. But in recent years, they have broadened out to a broader seafood agenda.
Like Cook's purchase last year of the Wan Cheese Fish Company in North Carolina. Icicle Seafoods has three main components: a major farm salmon operation in Washington State, its wild salmon arm in Alaska, and everything else it buys or has quota for in Alaska, like pollock, crab, halibut, black cod, and even togiak herring. Halse admits the wild stocks with their volatile markets weren't the immediate draw for Cook.
To be honest, the first interest point would have been the farm salmon operations in the state of Washington. That's what drew them to the opportunity. But the more I think that they ventured into understanding the full scope of the company and its three different business units, I think there was a real excitement and interest in acquiring the whole operation.
The purchase price between the private parties was not disclosed. Recognizing there's much yet to learn about its new acquisition, Hall says Icicle will stay a standalone company with few initial changes.
We're maintaining the management team. The CEO will continue to head up the company. So we're very fortunate we'll be able to learn from an experienced team of people.
She says Cook Seafoods likes the potential it sees, adding Icicle's farmed and wild products into what it feels is its own already strong customer base with good marketing and good distribution. Hulse adds that the family-run company keeps more in mind than just the bottom line.
Even though we're talking about a very important fishery in Alaska, it's also about coastal and rural communities and providing economic opportunity and jobs for people there.
Hulse says that CEO Glenn Cook already toured all of Icicle's facilities in Washington and Alaska as a first step to build relationships in an endeavor he aims to be in for the long haul. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Southeast Alaska's Regional Native Corporation is back in the seafood business. Juneau-based Sea Alaska on Monday announced the purchase of a minority share of a Seattle processing plant. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Independent Packers Corporation is a specialty plant that processes about 50 million pounds of seafood annually. It's the first of several investments the corporation plans to announce this year. Sea Alaska Chief Operating Officer Terry Downs says it's a successful enterprise insulated from some of the industry's ups and downs.
The reason we like the business is because it's in the middle of the supply chain. You know, they touch a lot of different seafood companies. They never actually own the resource themselves, so they're not exposed to commodity price fluctuations. And so, you know, the earnings are more stable.
Sea Alaska bought less than half of the company, making it a minority owner. Down says a confidentiality agreement prohibits him from releasing the amount invested or exact percentage purchased. He says the seafood business is part of a corporate strategy adopted in 2012.
In the past, Sea Alaska had owned businesses at arm's length, like plastics, injection molding, things like that. They didn't fit geographically, and they didn't fit with respect to the sector, and they didn't feel like businesses really felt like part of Sea Alaska and its ownership.
Sea Alaska has bought and sold companies for years, looking for new sources of revenue. But not everyone supports that strategy. Brad Flitch, a Juneau financial manager and Sea Alaska board candidate, says the purchases should stop. He's not ready to address the latest investment, but he says the stock market is a better bet.
Cavilco, the anchor corporation for the community of Kasan, you know, they have the right model. You know, and just be a passive portfolio company. They don't own any operating businesses.
Sea Alaska has invested in fisheries before. There was Ocean Beauty Seafoods in the 1980s, but it was sold. More recently, the corporation put money into reopening Cake's fish processing plant. It's also invested in oyster farming. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
An early breakup on the Copper River may accelerate salmon moving upstream. Glen Allen area state sport fish biologist Mark Somerville says little ice remains and water levels are unusually low, conditions that may lead to warmer water and trigger early fish migration.
I would anticipate them to be a little bit early just based on what I'm seeing, but don't hold me to that.
Somerville says the first sockeye and king salmon are usually counted moving up the lower Copper River in mid-May. Dip netting at Chitna is scheduled to open June 7th, the earliest it can under state regulations. The popular fishery is coming off a record 2015 harvest of 225,000 fish. It was the first year under an increased bag limit, but Somerville suspects several factors were likely in play.
I think it had something to do with it, but not nearly as much as people might think. Last year, we also had the largest number of fish ever come up the river, 1.3 million fish came past the sonar. So, and we also had excellent fishing conditions.
Somerville says participation was up with about 7,500 people dip netting at Chitna last summer. This year's Copper River salmon run is forecast to be more than 2.5 million fish, the 10th largest on record. The estimate includes 64,000 kings. The Chitna Dip Netters Association holds its annual meeting in Fairbanks tonight. Among agenda items is an update on safety upgrades to the trail between O'Brien and Haley Creeks, a primary access route for dip netters that suffered damage from landslides in past years.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
What can a tiny piece of dust do to you? It can stop you in your tracks. Studies show exposure to dust pollution can cause tightness in your chest, wheezing, and shortness of breath, even if you're healthy. When you're on an unpaved road, drive slowly, especially when operating an ATV. When hauling dirt, cover it up. Do your part, avoid dust, and clear the air. We'll all breathe easier. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Governor Bill Walker will name someone to a seat on the Alaska Supreme Court within the next few days. Four people have been nominated to fill the seat vacated by retiring Justice Dana Fabe. They include Susan Carney of the Office of Public Advocacy in Fairbanks, Superior Court Judge Andrew Guidi of Anchorage, Private Attorney Jana Lindemuth of Anchorage, and Superior Court Judge Philip Pallenberg of Juneau. Attorneys in the capital city are worried that the governor will pick someone who has little background or experience with Southeast Alaska issues. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story.
The Gino Bar Association, a voluntary, largely informal organization based in the capital city, recently drafted a letter urging Governor Bill Walker to consider someone from Southeast Alaska for appointment to the Alaska Supreme Court. The Gino Bar Association's Lael Harrison says they regretted not speaking up when a new justice was appointed in 2013 to fill the seat formerly held by retiring Justice Walter Carpinetti of Juneau. Harrison says a local or southeast appointment to the High Court could be important, for example, for their knowledge of the area geography, cultural differences, transportation challenges, and courtroom practices.
A justice and Supreme Court staff here in Juneau means that not only members of the bar, but also members of the public know these folks. Having a Supreme Court justice who is a neighbor, who is a local, really adds confidence in the judiciary for people of Southeast Alaska, that they have that sort of informal access and knowledge that their unique situation is being heard.
According to research by court system staff, this is not the first time that a judge or attorney from Juneau has not sat on the Supreme Court. The longest period occurred from 1980 to 1996. The court also lacked a representative from Fairbanks from 1997 to 2007.
There's certainly no rule or vested right for any community to have a justice represent, and the justices deal with statewide issues, not so much local issues.
Retired Alaska Supreme Court Justice Alexander Brinner. The Alaska Supreme Court has always been based out of Anchorage, although justices occasionally hear arguments in other communities and high schools around the state. When a vacancy opens up in any state courthouse, the nonpartisan independent Alaska Judicial Council solicits applications and then vets and interviews applicants for the bench. Executive Director Suzanne DiPietro says they evaluate all the applicants for their knowledge of Alaska law, competence, fairness, integrity, temperament, judgment, life experience, and commitment to public and community service.
I think there's a school of thought that says, you know, people who have all kinds of different experiences, whether they're from different socioeconomic classes, different geographical areas, different ethnicities, maybe, who've had those life experiences, people will say, you know, those are important things that are brought to the decision-making process, but not in terms of knowing things, knowing facts in the record, but in terms of just the way you think or analyze or view the world.
And Brinner, who served as chairman ex officio of the Alaska Judicial Council while he sat as chief justice, confirms that much more goes into evaluating candidates for the high court.
From my own experience, it's hard for me to conceive that the members of the council would pass up justice that they thought was heads and tails above another applicant just to make sure that they had geographical diversity. I mean, that's not the way it works.
When the council's done with the screening process, they usually send to the governor the names of at least two candidates they believe would be qualified. For the current vacancy on the Alaska Supreme Court, Governor Bill Walker has a choice of four nominees who currently make their home in Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau. Or another way to look at it, perhaps, he can pick from among two men and two women. According to the National Association of Women Judges, Alaska is well below the national average when it comes to appointing women to the bench. Depending on the governor's selection, Alaska could join Idaho and Iowa as the only states which do not have a woman sitting on the highest appellate-level court. Lael Harrison of the Juneau Bar Association says it's not like they believe that other forms of diversity are unimportant.
Obviously, there's lots of things to be considered in making an appointment. Lots of forms of diversity that matter, lots of forms of experience that matter. We just wanted to be heard about this one particular issue that we thought might not otherwise be on the governor's radar.
Governor Bill Walker has until May 15th to pick a new justice. It's possible he may announce his selection during the Alaska Bar Association annual convention starting May 11th in Anchorage. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
The Crown Princess cruise ship arrived unexpectedly in Juneau on Sunday. The ship was scheduled to arrive today. Kirby Day, manager of port operations for the Holland America Group, said operations in Vancouver, where the ship's journey began, were slower than usual.
There were three ships in Vancouver on Friday, and with about 8,500 people, the embarkation process just went very, very slow for all three ships. All three ships sailed late, including the Crown Princess.
Day says the ship is now heading to Skagway and Ketchikan. If you're a meat cutter, the state has a business idea for you. The state's Board of Agriculture and Conservation has issued a request for proposals to lease and operate the Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage Plant in Palmer. The proposed lease arrangement includes an option to purchase the plant. Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer has the story.
Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage is the only U.S. Department of Agriculture approved slaughterhouse in South Central Alaska. And without it, livestock producers in the area will not be able to sell meat commercially. The plant depends on state funding to keep its doors open, and that funding could dry up this year due to legislative budget cuts. Elizabeth Blumink, a spokesperson for the State Department of Natural Resources, says right now there is more than $2 million in this year's operating budget dedicated to the plant.
DNR's budget has mostly been settled. It still could be reopened. Currently, the status is that we have intent language that has been approved for the Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage Plant, as well as a funding level that would carry us through the upcoming fiscal year.
The budget is currently in conference committee. Blumink says the conference committee has adopted intent language, which would allow for a one-time increment funding for the meat plant for the next fiscal year to allow the plant to operate while negotiations for a lease are in progress.
The intent language is really important because that is partly what is driving the process that's going on right now with the RFP for the meat plant.
The BAC wants to put the meatpacking plant into private ownership with the contingent that it continues to operate as a slaughterhouse. A deadline for submitting a proposal is July 11th. The plant is an asset of the state's Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund. Previous efforts to privatize the meat plant by issuing RFPs for lease or sale took place in 2000, 2002, and 2006. No acceptable proposals were received at those times. Salaries for three permanent employees at the meat plant cost about $360,000 annually. Mount McKinley has lost an average of $110,000 a year every year for a decade, except for 2014, when it earned $155,000 in profits. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman, Matt Miller, Ed Schoenfeld, and Jennifer Canfield in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. The outside view of the Arctic is a place of mythic proportions, fantastical, romantic, and mysterious. Contemporary artists break open the mythical idea of the Arctic in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, A View from Up Here, The Arctic at the Center of the World. Take a revealing look at the Arctic as a place of adaptation, complex landscapes, and diverse people. See The View from Up Here at the Anchorage Museum, open daily 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.